This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, I'm delighted to have in the studio with me the environmentalist and author Bill McKibben, who's been warning about global warming since he wrote The End of Nature almost 2 decades ago, if you can believe that. His most recent book is Deep Economy, The Wealth of Communities, and the Durable Future. And right now, he's organizing for protests around the country up on April 14th in an endeavor called Step It Up 2007. Bill McKibben, welcome to Progressive Radio.
It's awful good to be here.
What is Step It Up 2007?
Well, there's a little bit of a backstory to it. You want to hear it?
Sure, we got plenty of time.
Last summer, as you said, I wrote the first book about global warming. So I've spent the last 18 years sort of looking on with a certain amount of despair as we've had an enormously successful bipartisan effort to accomplish nothing whatsoever on this topic. And at some point last year, I just got crazed enough by all of this that decided I had to do something. But I am a writer, not an activist. So I called up a couple of my friends. I live in Vermont, and said, let's walk up to Burlington and go sit in at the federal building and get arrested, and maybe something will happen. Who knows? And they all said okay, but one of them actually was wise enough to call the Burlington police and ask what would happen if we did that, and the answer turned out to be absolutely nothing. They would just let us sit there as long as we wanted, and you know, we weren't going to burn the building down because of the carbon emissions and things. So we had
Plus
to—
Plus, you're not an arsonist.
We had to think of something else. So we organized this sort of pilgrimage, invited everyone we knew to join us on a 5-day walk across Vermont. By the time we got to Burlington, we had 1,000 people, which in Vermont's quite a bit, and it was enough to really change the political. Even the very conservative Republicans running for Congress and Senate ended up strong advocates of ambitious action on global warming. But the depressing thing was to pick up the newspaper the next day and read that 1,000 people that we'd assembled was the largest demonstration that there'd yet been in this country on climate change.
Wow, why do you think that was?
Well, I'm not sure why that was, but it certainly made me understand why ExxonMobil was having such a hell of an easy time, you know, making sure nothing happened. I mean, there just was no— it was interesting. We've had all the superstructure of a movement, you know, the scientists and the engineers and the economists. We've had Al Gore with his great educational campaign. We've had all the parts of the movement except the movement part.
But part of the movement part, I thought, was, well, you have the Washington establishment groups, the old one, Audubon, then Sierra Club and Natural Resources Defense Council and what used to be called Environmental Action. And there were groups around the country, local groups, and Greenpeace, of course. So I'm surprised that no one has put on a demonstration against global warming.
Well, in a sense, I am too.
Anyway.
Although, you know, most of those groups have had other things that they've had to be focused on. And global warming, in a sense, it's almost too much to kind of ask the big environmental groups, even the, you know, which by comparison are really not that big at all, to take on. I mean, they're geared to fight wars over drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge or, you know, getting people to put catalytic converters on their car. They're not geared toward taking on the heart of the American economy. I mean, they're just not big enough and powerful enough to do that. That's why we need, I think, a new kind of real movement. So in January, me and 6 students who had graduated in the last year from Middlebury College launched this website, stepitup07.org. And we asked people to organize rallies around the country on April 14th. Now, we could have done a march on Washington, but, you know, A, we didn't have the organizational skill to do it. B, we didn't really want throngs of people spewing carbon into the atmosphere as they crossed the continent. And see, we thought it would be better to have people sort of close to home reaching, you know, making sure their own congressmen understood that there were people in their districts who cared and able to kind of point to the things around them that made them so scared about climate change. So we launched this website. We figured, well, you know, maybe if we work really hard, we'll be able to get 100 of these rallies by April 14th, which would have been about 100 times more than there'd been in the past. Instead, and I should be clear, not due to any great skill in organizing that any of us possessed, just because people really had a deep desire, untapped desire to do something about this problem. I mean, we're now above 1,100 of these rallies scheduled with about a little less than 2 weeks to go till April 14th.
And that's amazing. I'm speaking with Bill McKibben. You're listening to Progressive Radio. Bill McKibben is the author of The End of Nature, of course, and also Deep Economy, his latest book. But he's been very active, as we've been talking about right now, in this organizing effort geared toward April 14th called Step It Up 2007. You can find out more about it at the website, stepitup07.org. What are you asking people to do who are participating in these actions?
Well, it's less what we're asking than what they're coming up with. The only common denominator is that we're all in favor of cutting carbon emissions at least 80% by 2050.
What's the magic of 80%?
There's no scientific study that says 81% would be too much and 79% too little. And I mean, but that's in the ballpark of what the scientists like Jim Hansen at NASA have said. And what it really is a way to use federal policy to do the one thing that state and local governments can't do, which is send a really strong price signal about fossil fuel, to say that we're going to be serious about cleansing fossil fuel out of our economy, and the way we're going to do that is by making the price go up steadily for 40 years. So if you're making some investments now, you better take that into account. We need that. We need to sort of reorient the force of economic gravity away from fossil fuel. But people have, I mean, what's been amazing is not just that the numbers in which people have responded, but the real creativity with which they've responded. You might remember there was an essay about a year ago saying, you know, environmentalism is dead, that everybody, the death of environmentalism that everyone was sort of talking about. Well, I think the obituary may have been a bit premature. We have teams of scuba divers in the Florida Keys who are going to be holding underwater demonstrations on the endangered coral reefs. There are going to be thousands of people in blue shirts crowding into lower Manhattan in a kind of sea of people to show where the tide line will come once the sea begins to rise. Teams of skiers skiing in formation down the dwindling glaciers in the Rockies. There are going to be people holding hands along some of the levees in New Orleans, who, you know, people who know better than any other Americans what the price of climate change really looks like.
How much did Katrina galvanize things, do you think?
I think Katrina blew open the door, and I think Al Gore walked through it with his brilliant movie. I think those were the two biggest events in the last while.
And the impact of Gore's movie?
It made it very clear to people who had a kind of, you know, vague sense that there was something wrong, that the something was much larger and much more immediate than they'd understood. And I think it really, I think that's why we've been able to move people to action, was because he moved them to despair.
Bill McKibben, did you relate to Al Gore as kind of the Willie Loman of global warming? Because in some respects, you are as well.
It's been a long 18 years, and there certainly were times, I think, when anyone who was working on this felt like, you know, they were in one of those nightmares where you keep screaming, but no, nothing comes out of your mouth, and everyone just goes on about their business and doesn't see the big monster, you know, looming in the distance. So it's heartening in a sense now to see real political activism beginning to build. It's tough that we've waited this long, because it means that, you know, it means that we're not going to stop global warming. At the very least, we're going to at the very most, we're going to keep it to a miserable and not catastrophic level.
So we're closer to the precipice. Some people said we're over the precipice.
There are.
With this tipping point idea.
Frankly, we may be. I mean, there is a possibility that we've already set in motion physical forces so large that they'll overwhelm whatever we do.
But not only is that depressing, though, that paralyzes people from acting.
The best science seems to say that there is a narrow and quickly closing window in which to operate. Jim Hansen from NASA, our leading climatologist, and a guy who has defied the efforts of three administrations to gag him at one time or another, said this time last year that we would, if we didn't reverse the flow of carbon into the atmosphere in the next decade, in his words, we would, quote, be living on a totally different planet, which is strong language for a scientist, which he is, and he meant it.
One striking thing to me is that people in other countries, have, especially in Canada and in Europe, have taken global warming much more seriously than we have. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think there's a kind of obvious practical reason. We use so much more fossil fuel than anybody else per capita that it's, you know, we're more deeply addicted. That's weird, you know. I mean, the Europeans will have a much harder time cutting the next 80% out of their fossil fuel use because they already use half as much as we do, and that they're taking much stronger steps than we are now.
And you say in your book, Deep Economy, Bill, excuse me for interrupting, they've already picked the low-hanging fruit.
They're cutting into muscle now. We've got lots of fat to trim. The first 10 years of this are going to be pretty easy, you know. But I think the other reason really is the one that I talk about in Deep Economy, that we've allowed a culture that's so hyper-individualistic that it's extremely difficult for us to start factoring in, you know, anything that affects the larger whole.
And isn't there the assumption that we can always find the next technological quick fix?
I think that's been the assumption, and I think the people who hold it are beginning to, some of them are beginning to wonder, because it's very clear that there is no silver bullet that's going to get us out of this. There may be, you know, if we're lucky, there's enough silver buckshot that if we pick up all of it, you know, we'll have some chance. But we already had our magic fuel. I mean, it's important to understand how special coal and gas and oil have been, full of BTUs, easy to get at, easy to transport. It's pretty much magic. The only two problems are, one, we're starting to run out at least of oil, and two, much more important, we're destroying the planet in the course of burning it. But other than that, it was good stuff.
I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor of the Progressive Magazine. You're listening to Progressive Radio. My guest today, Bill McKibben, author of the latest book of his, Deep Economy, The Wealth of Communities and the Durable Future. You may remember him as the author of The End of Nature, and you may soon become familiar with him more as an activist, because he's involved in this huge organizing around April 14th, a movement called Step It Up 2007. I want to talk a little bit more about the book. Deep Economy is obviously an echo of deep ecology. What are you trying to convey?
Well, I think that it's probably time that we stop concentrating on a set of on the sort of obvious questions about the economy, most of which in our society have focused on how can we make it bigger, and start asking questions more like the one that Wendell Berry posed in the title of one of his books, What's an Economy For? I think that there are two contentions that underlie the book. One, that rapid economic growth is probably no longer ecologically possible, the model that we imagine, because it has been the product, and still is around the world, the product of the exploitation of cheap fossil fuel. And if we keep doing that, we're in a pickle that whose dimensions are so much larger than anything humans have ever done that we'd better stay away. The second half of the argument, though, and in a sense newer and less obvious, I think, deals with a lot of this research that started coming to light in the last decade or so, as a few economists and other academics have begun to ask a very subversive question, which is whether or not the economic growth that we're fixated on actually makes us any happier or more satisfied in the end.
It's subversive of the field of economics.
It's
traditionally
is.
Understood anyway.
Well, economics always posited that you didn't need to even ask that question, because by definition, you know, that's what utility meant. What made people happy was what they bought, you know, ipso facto. Even though, you know, even the dimmest economist knew that at some level in their own personal life that wasn't true, it was a pretty convenient way of, you know, at least pretending that what we could measure was really important. Instead, economists have begun to try to measure, and others, to try to measure more directly people's sense of their own satisfaction or well-being. And it turns out that not only are those indices going down, I mean, the number of Americans who will say they're very happy with their lives peaks in the mid-1950s and just kind of subsides ever since then. Not only is it going down, which is weird enough since the 50s we've trebled our material standard of living, and if the economy worked exactly the way we thought it did, those two curves should move in some kind of tandem. But there seems to be a fair amount of evidence to suggest that in certain ways it's actually our ascent into affluence that's causing a lot of that dissatisfaction. I mean, what did we start spending money on in the 50s? We started building bigger houses farther out in the suburbs. And, of course, we got the first of the set of screens into which we've spent the last five decades peering. Those things began disconnecting us from other people. And that disconnection's pretty profound. The number of close friends that the average American has is about half what it was 50 years ago.
What is that number? Do you know?
It went from like 9 to like 5 or something like that. Those are, and it turns out that, you know, changes like that are more important maybe than the whatever satisfaction came from, you know, accumulating more things. I mean, there's this point at which it almost turns to farce, and we may be getting there. I mean, the average American house has doubled in size in the last generation, even as the number of people living in it has steadily shrunk. There was a story in the Times a couple of weeks ago about how the new trend, at least in high-end housing, is dual master bedrooms because husbands and wives don't really, you know, one of them snores or something, so they need another suite of bedrooms.
I told my wife that. She wasn't keen on the idea.
The kind of disconnect, well, that's good. That says good things about your marriage. That kind of disconnection from other people has become a profound part of our landscape. And I guess the good news is, as far as I'm concerned with the book, is that it seems to me that the kind of partial answer to both these problems may lie a little bit in the same direction, in rebuilding much tighter local economies that, on the one hand, use a lot less in the way of energy, and on the other hand, just by their nature, create more in the way of connections between people.
How can they use less energy?
Well, I mean, let's take an example. And since we're in Madison, let's talk about local food. This town has maybe the greatest farmer's market in the country.
It is a point of pride here.
Yeah. And, you know, for the most part, Americans order takeout from 2,000 miles away every night. I mean, that's how far the average bite of food travels in this country before it reaches our lips. That takes a lot of energy. You want to eat lettuce this time of year, it's coming from California, and growing it and transporting it here is taking about 36 calories of fossil energy for every calorie of lettuce that you get. And the lettuce is pretty limp anyway by the time it arrives. So you use a lot less energy. And at the same time, this pair of academics followed shoppers a couple of years ago, first around supermarkets and then around farmers markets. And it was really interesting. You know, everybody knows what happens when you go to the supermarket. You fall into a light daze and you sort of visit the same stations of the cross and you come out with somehow the same pile of items that you had the week before, and maybe you sort of discuss paper versus plastic with the person at the checkout. When they went to the farmer's market, people had 10 times more conversations. It wasn't, you know, just a slightly different way of acquiring calories. It was an entirely different experience. And clearly that's one of the reasons that people like that experience, that it matters to them, that it's rich in relationship.
What about lettuce is grown here in Wisconsin only from, you know, April 15th till, October 15th if they're lucky.
Right.
We're not supposed to eat lettuce over the winter?
Well, I did a part of this book. I did this experiment where our family spent the winter in Vermont up near the Canadian border too, eating only food that came from our valley all winter long. And, you know, it was fine. We sort of forgot about lettuce and tomatoes because we had squash and beets and root vegetables and all kinds of stuff. Not to mention that we'd frozen a fair amount of tomatoes, you know, before the winter began.
Well,
I mean,
tomatoes,
it's worth remembering.
The out-of-season tomatoes aren't tomatoes.
Aren't worth too much. It's worth remembering that everyone on Earth ate basically locally until 50 years ago, and 85% of people on Earth still eat almost entirely locally. It's not, I mean, it's only sort of hard for us to imagine because we've turned our food system into such an insane, industrialized, centralized thing that we've gotten rid of most of the local agricultural infrastructure, but it can come back in a hurry because, among other things, there are lots of people who'd like to farm in this country. I mean, we've gotten to the point where there were many more prisoners than farmers in the U.S., but it doesn't need to be that way. I have student after student at Middlebury College, where I teach, who come out of that school wanting nothing more than to go open a small farm, and a lot of them are doing it. And if we can figure out how to make those kind of opportunities, we can see things happen like are happening in Madison or in Oregon, where the number of farms has almost doubled in the last decade as local food really gets up and rolling.
And I see that in your book you have a statistic that organic farming is one of the fastest-growing industries or fractions of an industry.
Well, what's interesting about organic food, of course, is that it's been successfully, to too large a degree, successfully co-opted by, once it got popular, Heinz and Del Monte and ConAgra and everybody else moved in. Those are the big organic growers now. And in fact, if you're worried about things like global warming, if you go to the supermarket, the average bite of organic food often travels further than the average bite of conventional food. So
that's not necessarily a solution.
The real solution, I think, is local food, is and local energy and local culture and figuring out how to build communities that are way more durable and resilient than the very vulnerable communities we have at the moment, a vulnerability that's likely to be more exposed in a century in which things like global warming begin to kick in. You know, we could be pulled there by the desire for closer connection, or we will, I think, be pushed there by the fact that as we run out of cheap oil and as we are unable to keep burning fossil fuel because of climate change, we're going to have very little choice.
But is the price going to be exorbitant? Is that why?
Well, it will be exorbitant if we ever take seriously the damage that it's doing. You know, I mean, that's why we're doing this step it up demonstrate. I mean, that's what we need from our federal government is some kind of beginning down the path of making fossil fuel accountable for the costs it's exacting on the environment, which means the costs it's exacting on the poorest and most vulnerable people here and especially around the rest of the world.
Bill McKibben, you said earlier in our conversation that there was a systematic bipartisan effort to do absolutely nothing about global warming over the last 20 years. Do you see that changing in Washington right now?
It'll change in Washington only to the degree that we make it change. I mean, something's going to happen in the next few years because, you know, they're going to need at the very least some window dressing. There's going to be a deal made of some kind. The oil companies and the coal companies are smart. They know that their complete free license is about to expire when, you know, thank the Lord, George Bush finally leaves office. And, you know, so they're going to cut the best deal they can. We have to make sure, I mean, the point of being politically involved right now is to make sure that that deal is as strong as it possibly can be because it has to be. I mean, if we'd started 20 years ago, Matt, we'd be, you know, we would have been able to go gradually and slowly and so forth. We didn't. And so now we have to go more ambitiously than really we'd like to, I think.
Well, why don't you talk a little bit more, Bill McKibben, about the Step It Up 2007 campaign. You mentioned some of the different activities and activism that's going to happen on April 14th. There are different kinds of people involved, too, that not just your usual green students.
Absolutely. there are There are some students involved, but there are at least as many people from a really wide variety of, you know, big involvement by evangelical churches and by a lot of religious groups. This has become one of the things that's happened in the last couple of years, after a lot of work by a lot of us over the years, is the emergence of a real religious environmental movement. On sort of liberal churches, it's joined poverty and hunger as an issue to care about. And, you know, in evangelical churches, it's been the first issue in which the kind of that movement has broken with the orthodoxy of the Bush administration and begun to demand real change. It's actually quite inspiring to see
there's some backlash by that orthodoxy too.
There's some, and it's a real test as to whether Jerry Falwell is going to. I think Jerry Falwell and those guys are on their way out. If you go to the sort of evangelical seminaries and schools and things, which I do, you sense a desire for a much larger and less constrained vision of you know what the gospel means. So we got religious groups, we've got somehow tapped into this just real burst of creativity. You know, environmentalism, one of its problems has been that it's kind of boring and sober.
Or legalistic.
Maybe that's a good synonym for boring, you know. It's not been, for instance, a singing movement, you know. We've found this group of songwriters who had set up a website that was encouraging people to write songs about global warming, and they've started uploading them to our website, and there's dozens upon dozens now of some of them really quite good songs, you know. And even when we're in, you know, in sort of demographics that you might think of as like students, the whole thing is shifting fast. We got in the email the other day a photograph from University of Texas at Austin, the Alpha Phi sorority, 180 sorority girls with a banner that said, step it up, cut carbon 80% by 2050. And they sent along a little note saying, you know, we want to show that it's not just the hippies who care about this. And I actually thought that was really sweet because, you know, all these sort of things start with hippies. I mean, one way or another, those of us who kind of think weird thoughts about the world and for whatever reason are moved to do something about them. But they only get finished when they're joined by sorority girls and by, you know, evangelical congregations and by all the rest of the walks of life who are sometimes a little suspicious of hippies, you know, and that kind of sorority hippie alliance is beginning to build is a very good sign, I think.
We have only about a minute or 30 seconds left. What would you do, Bill McKibben, on the day after April 14th, after you've galvanized these 1,100 or more protests around the country with Step It Up 2007? What is the next step?
I don't know. I do know that in the next few years, the next piece of this puzzle has to be to figure out how to get the same kind of citizens' movement underway around the world. The most shameful thing that the Bush administration has done, maybe, on a long list, has been to disengage from the rest of the world in these discussions about these questions. And we've got to get back in because it takes – I mean, they don't call it global warming for nothing.
That's going to have to be the last word. Bill McKibben has been my guest. He's the author of Deep Economy, The End of Nature Before That, and the chief organizer, or one of them, of an exciting endeavor, Step It Up 2007. You can find that at stepitup07.org. Thanks for being my guest today.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.